Okay, let's go.
All right. Good morning, folks. My name is Sam. I'm a program manager in the Active Directory team. I've been in the Active Directory space since I first joined Microsoft about 14 years ago. So it's great to actually have done quite a few sessions this conference. And it's a much more cozier environment today compared to yesterday. So we had a much larger room and a crowd yesterday. With me, I have Ulf, who's an Active Directory MVP, and he'll introduce himself later when he's doing a part of the presentation. So we have quite a few things to cover today. Now, I think I just heard, you know, this is somewhere between a 300 and 400. The expectation is that you're well aware of Active Directory, domain controllers, some of the operations, and our focus today is to talk a little about what our overall broad theme of investments is for Active Directory in Windows Server 2012. And we're going to talk about, give you an overview of all the functionality improvements that we've made relating to Active Directory in Windows Server 2012. The way the deck is actually focused is such that for most of these areas, we're going to talk a little about the problem. We're going to talk about what we did to solve them. There's a lot of information in the deck. There's quite a few slides. But the focus was so that we may not get to each of these details within the slide deck, but be able to, for you to be able to go back, look at the content, and then actually get more information out of it. So a couple of things is that, one is whenever I say sometimes, I've noticed myself saying Windows Server 8, and that was the internal view of the name, and now it's Server 2012. So do keep that in context. I'll do my best to keep saying Windows Server 2012. So any questions, we have a Twitter tag, and Ulf is monitoring them. So where possible, we'll try to kind of answer them through the presentation. If not, we're always available after the session as well. So feel free to stop by and ask questions. So let's start by thinking about how we thought about investments. When we started planning for Windows Server 2012, Active Directory has been there in the enterprise for nearly a decade. We've got a lot of customers who use Active Directory. So our focus fundamentally was essentially to see what are the core pain points that customers are facing and trying to find enough number of trends and address them. In addition, there were some series of issues that we really wanted to kind of have fixed, so we focused on working on them as well. And so when we took a look at that, it was about two places where we really wanted to make sure that we invested. One was about easier to manage and easier, the other was easier to deploy. So these will be two consistent themes that you see throughout most of the investments that we've made. Now, in addition, we also made some, we made some investments into a new area of claims-based technology, which is Dynamic Access Control Overview, Dynamic Access Control, for which we had a couple of sessions on Wednesday. How many of you went to the DAC sessions on Wednesday? All right. So how many of you attended my virtualization session yesterday? Okay. So I'm just trying to do a quick gauge to see what I can potentially skip over a little quickly and where to focus on through this presentation. All right. So when we looked at our broad goals, so you can look at it as a three key pieces on where we invested. One is about we've seen a huge trend of people employing domain controllers on virtualized platforms. So, and we also seen through our support channels a huge number of issues that keep popping up because people either aren't aware of what are the constraints that an Active Directory domain administrator or a Hyper-V admin have to employ and perform operations in such a way that you can have safe domain controllers. So we've seen a set of issues out there, and we just wanted to make sure that virtualization just works. Now, we didn't just stop out there. We did a series of improvements as part of embracing the virtualization trend that's happening across the enterprise because most companies look at it and say,
I really want to cut down the cost of my infrastructure servers. Virtualization gives me a great opportunity to do that. So we continue to kind of expand and embracing that trend. Now, the other aspect was about simplifying our deployment. And one of the things that we noticed was that people were having trouble essentially moving from one version of Active Directory to another. And there were a series of errors, and this would result in support calls. And we went and analyzed what was actually the root cause of each issue. And we had like a series of specific conditions that failed in customers' environments. And our focus was to look at, say, how can we improve this overall deployment experience? In addition, we also saw a lot of feedback where people made mistakes because certain parts were not optimized. And we said, how can we improve and optimize those parts while promoting domain controllers or creating new Active Directory environments? Finally, thinking about management. There were a series of both platform aspects as well as UI improvements that customers were asking for. And that was a focus theme for us, is saying, how can we do management in a consistent manner? So this included not only UI changes, but core platform changes, because when thinking about problems with Kerberos constrained delegation, we kind of bucketed it under management, because this is how customers would like to kind of manage their environment. So we made a few improvements out there. I will also be talking about various other features that's around the Active Directory ecosystem that we did in Windows 8, but I'll probably be very quick about that as well. So let's get started. Excuse me. So focus on simplified deployment. How many of you know what AD Prep is? How many of you have had a fairly, how many of you like AD Prep? All right. So we've heard a lot of complaints about AD Prep, the fact that it was really archaic, it was obfuscated in some sense. People didn't understand the sequence of operations that needed to happen. You had to go locally. You had to find which platform that AD Prep was for, because people would make mistakes even about that. And at the end of it, people made a lot of errors that resulted in potential support costs for us as well. So what did we do? We took AD Prep and pretty much took a gun and shot it in its head. So AD Prep doesn't exist in its old form in Windows Server 2012. And then not only did that, we took DC Promo, which was a huge wizard that had kind of organically grown over the years. And we said, how can we take this and polish this up to really optimize it for certain flows? So in Windows Server 2012, what we've done is we've embraced the concept of the server manager to its fullest extent. So we've taken the standard paradigms about server manager. Has anyone played with the new server manager? All right, that's good. So we've taken that. We've done all the goodness of ensuring that our core deployment actions across preparing your forest, preparing your domain, are all PowerShell enabled. And we integrated that with a new UI that you can see through Server Manager. So your experience is going to be, hey, I'm going to install a server, add the role of a domain controller, and you're going to be guided through the full experience. Similarly, in Server Core, you have the full series of PowerShell commandlets to deploy your domain controllers. One key thing is that I just mentioned that AD Prep, you know, we killed it. But we didn't kill it in its entirety. You still need that action. What we did was take AD Prep and integrate it within the deployment experience. So when you promote a new domain controller, we detect what are the conditions that need to happen for us to get a new domain controller with a new version of Active Directory into your environment. We check for the appropriate conditions, and we help you sequence all the way through, say, oh, do I need to run forest prep first? Do I need to run domain prep? You know, GP prep is integrated. All of those aspects are well underneath in your environment, and we guide you through that process. So this is what you get in the new, you could call it the DC Promo Plus, or the new DC Promo, or just Server Manager integration for deploying domain controllers. We've integrated that into one experience so that you can be guided through that sequence with the least amount of errors. Now, coming to errors, Now, we also added, based on our support calls, we knew a series of conditions that people were tripping up on. So, for example, in some cases, the schema FISMO was not available. So you'd start a DC promo process, or you'd start a forest prep, it essentially fails. So what we did was that we built about 10 to 15 tests that we thought were the most common patterns. And we also integrated into the deployment experience so that we do not kick off a domain controller until and unless we're sure that all these common patterns are not likely to result in error conditions. So that's one of the core value propositions that we think will help customers get to a place where they are deploying domain controllers with far fewer errors, and it will result in a lesser number of support calls for Microsoft as well. Now, of course, it's kind of implicit, but at the same time, I do want to mention, all of the capabilities of deployment are now fully remotable. So you can be sitting in a machine where, because Server Manager is remotable as well, so I can have a server from which I can be connecting to different machines, have the full guided UI experience, and every aspect. So now I can be doing that across multiple machines with Server Manager concepts that's provided in Windows Server 2012, and be able to kind of look at deploy my whole environment without having to TS into any specific machine. Any questions on this? Goodness? All right. So going back, just to reiterate, what did we do? From streamlining the deployment process, what we did was ensure that all aspects of prerequisite checking is integrated within the deployment experience. We added a series of tests within the deployment experience by validating the environment to avoid the types of errors that we've seen in the past. We've added remote capabilities to avoid having to, like, TS into one of the forest DCs, TS into one of each domain DC to run your prep environment. All those are taken care of with remote story. And then we have enhanced the UI, or built a new UI that optimizes the paths for the most common experience. For example, we said, at this point in time, trying to get the replica DC and flow right is our top priority, because most customers are building replica DCs rather than building new domains, because they already have an Active Directory domain. In some cases, we looked at saying that, okay, for a new domain, yes, because people are doing restructuring. So we were thinking from that perspective as we built out our UI for this. In addition, we looked at, this is part of the same server paradigms. It's fully integrated with Server Manager. excuse me. Finally, we have a great consistent story, because a whole UI is built on PowerShell. So whatever the UI is doing, you can do in a fully scriptable environment if that's what you would like to kind of do. All right. In terms of requirements, it's fairly simple. Now, one thing that I want to point out here is that, for the most part, through all our features and improvements that we've done in Active Directory, we focused really hard. And in some cases, we had to spend hours thinking about design choices to ensure that most customers are getting value for new functionality without having to move to new functional levels. And this is something that you will see as a theme across most of the new functionality that we've done. We wanted to put the control and provide the ability for admins to be able to make the right set of choices and not have to be pushed into what they believe is an irreversible decision. Now, a few more things that we have also improved as part of our deployment process. These are small, but one interesting fact for you is excuse me. One interesting fact for you is that we actually run Active Directory in our own online environments for our online services. So Exchange Online, for example, actually runs Active Directory and uses that quite extensively in our cloud environment. What, as part of that, and as well as getting some customer feedback, we realized that one area of IFM where it was difficult was preparing IFM media was taking a lot of time because we forced you to do an offline defragmentation. In Windows Server 2012, we said, okay, that's let's give the control to the admin. And we do have added a switch that says, all right, don't do offline defrag, which potentially gives you time saving if you're dealing with a large database and you're using install from media. But at the same point in time, the result will be is a potentially a slightly larger database as a result of that. So we want to give admins the control to be able to do this. Now, another thing is that we shipped ADFS 2.0, which is the Active Directory Federation Services, as an out-of-band Windows component that released about 2 years ago. What we've done in Windows Server 2012 is that what used to live in Windows Server prior to that, we call it the ADFS 1.x code base, we removed that out and we've pushed the ADFS 2.x code base as an inbuilt role in Windows Server 2012. This way, you get all those benefits that you got with ADFS 2.0, which was a big step and a newer model for claims-based applications. So we provided that in Windows Server 2012. One aspect of this, that benefit that you get, which is unique in the Windows Server 2012 environment, is when you combine that with what is known as compound identity. How many of you know what compound identity is? A very few people. Compound identity is a concept that we added as part of dynamic access control overview. Dynamic access control. Now, in that case, what we've done is that we've taken not only the user's attributes, and we've also added the device's attributes as a Windows token when presented to a service. So the service ticket not only contains user information, user SIDs and user claims, it also contains device SIDs and device claims from Windows 8 domain joined machines. So it gives you the ability to run more authorization decisions based on device-based data. An example of that scenario is that I only want to allow access from domain joined machines that belong to the finance department. So you have the capability to drive scenarios of that with dynamic access control. Now, with ADFS 2.1, we can use that Windows service ticket that contains this richer information, both from users and devices, and be able to project it to any application that's claims-based or SAML-aware, and be able to consume that and drive authorization behaviors. For example, in the Build conference last year, I did a demo where we had an Azure web role, and all we did was authorize an action, said that it has to be from a machine that was part of the finance department, and we passed that all through claims. Any questions so far? All right. Am I going too fast, too slow? Just right? All right. So since I did have only about 30 to 40%, I'm just going to quickly talk about some of the virtualization improvements that we did. Now, one of the key things that we've seen through our support channels was more number of cases that gone into what is known as USN bubbles. USN bubbles is a place where, due to a virtualization action that rolled back in time, and because of the fact that Active Directory does not know about this rollback, data is going to stay diverged across the different nodes in an Active Directory environment. So what it means is that Active Directory is a distributed database. It relies on a vector clock algorithm to ensure that data is convergent across all the nodes. There's a fairly complex replication algorithm piece that understands how to keep all the data in sync across all the nodes in the environment. Now, it's typically known as KCC. Now, in the event that virtualization steps back in time, you know, causes an action that steps back in time, without Active Directory knowing about it, we get into a place called USN bubbles, because at this point in time, Active Directory will not be able to understand that rollback in time because it was not notified about this. How did we go about fixing this? It was fairly simple. As long as we could get notification from the hypervisor platform, we would be able to handle that. we already had a lot of the components as part of dealing with this resetting. Think of this as a reset, so that the environment knows how to reset itself and ensure data is consistent across all the nodes. Now, this is a core capability. We worked with our Hyper-V team in Windows Server 2012, and we generated this new concept called VM Generation ID. VM Generation ID is an identifier that the hypervisor platform guarantees to be the same as long as the machine has a consistent time continuum. If ever the machine is rolled back in time, or if ever it does not know if there is an action that rolls back in time, the hypervisor platform guarantees that it will update this VM generation ID to a new one. Think of it as nothing but a GUID that is now available. Now, what we worked with the hypervisor team and then said, okay, how can we make that available to the Active Directory environment? And with Hyper-V, we've made it available through the BIOS, so it looks like a BIOS setting from the guest machine. Now, if you just think about it for a second, this makes life a lot more simpler. Now we know of a state from the hypervisor platform if ever there is a potential to roll back in time. Now, all we had to do was essentially capture that information and store it into our database, and from where we can see if something changed from what we knew how to, okay, now is a point where there's potential change, and we had to go reset it ourselves. And what we did was we do this check in two places because of how hypervisor is. We did one check was essentially where on boot up we always check this to see if whatever is available from the hypervisor platform is the same as what is in our database, or whenever we make a database commit, we actually go check that. Now, the reason why we did the second aspect was because if someone had by mistake taken a snapshot when a domain controller was up, live, and running, it already has a live execution context. And if they reapply that snapshot, what happens is that there's a next database transaction that happens, a commit that happens to the directory. At that point in time, we've already have potential for losing changes. So on every database commit, we actually go check this, and it's a fairly quick operation because it's BIOS and it's there in the it's in memory. So for us, it's a very quick transaction for us to be able to do that, and the cost of it was very low. So what you get in Windows Server 2012 is a much safer story with virtualization. So we do not, after discussing this with the Hyper-V team as well as within the Active Directory team, as well as having a few discussions with the partner teams, we do not recommend snapshot and restore as a valid supported mechanism for domain controllers. There are varying reasons for that. In future, maybe we'll continue to kind of work with the hypervisor platforms to make sure that this could be considered as part of that. But today, it is not a recommended or supported. What we did was we wanted to make sure that doing those actions do not result in a unsafe environment where data has diverged. So we've taken that first step to say, all right, we need to embrace virtualization much more and drive that. And we provided a safety mechanism for us to be able to detect these changes and be able to handle that. So the key portion of it, you know, in pictorial view, let me kind of quickly go through that, is that think of T1 as being where you had a snapshot that happened. You've got a USN of 100, you've got an ID of A, and then you also have a RID pool of 500 to 1,000. So a RID pool is when domain controllers, when creating new security principles, use these RID pools that are unique across every nodes so that we can create unique SIDs in the environment when you create security principles. Now, if you created 100 users, assume that the USN moves up to 200, and we've used about 100 of our RIDs as part of that. Your DC2 receives these updates. But if you did apply a snapshot back where you've kind of reset back to USN 100 and IDA and RID pool of 500 to 1,000, when you now create 150 users, what happens is that the USNs now move from 100 to 250, and the RIDs have now been reused from 500 to 600, and the 600 to 650 is potentially unique in the environment. Because of the USNs moving only from 100 to 250 as part of adding a new 150 users here, DC2 already thinks it is up to date with USN up to 200. So what will result in is that DC2 only receives 50 of those users as opposed to 150 users. And additionally, because we've reused RIDs in this case, what's going to result is we're going to get conflicting SIDs, and users who could have logged on in the past suddenly would not be able to log on, which will potentially generate support cost as well. All right. Key point to mention out here is that, yes, it is only reliant on this capability is only available in Windows Server 2012 domain controllers and requires a Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V platform. Now, VM generation ID, what we've done is we've made that as a generic concept, and we're working with the other hypervisor vendors as well to make sure that future versions of their product will also support this. I don't have any timelines to commit, but we're actively working with them. All right. So in terms of rapid deployment, what we've done essentially was that we took the virtualization concept and said, oh, you know, hey, we've kind of gotten to this place. We've gotten this VM generation ID. We made it a little safer. Can we take it a step further and use virtualization as a core mechanism in which potentially we can enable a few new scenarios? So as part of that, we said, okay, we know that traditionally you can't clone member machines because of the security infrastructure associated with that. Because otherwise, you know, the way you clone is that it's a work machine, you sysprep a bunch of things, and then you can then join them and then drive them so that, because whatever is unique needs to be unique. But then we looked at ourselves and said, hey, we're the Active Directory team. We own the security infrastructure on that machine. Can we do something better? And we took that now. We've taken the first step where you can clone domain controllers. So you can take a machine and decide, hey, I wanted a replica. And it's a simple cloning operation for you to do, where all you have to do is export that machine, copy that VHD, create a new machine, and you have a brand new replica. And the way we do this is because 1A is that we control the underlying security infrastructure. So what we, as an interesting fact, which is probably a 400-level detail here, is that what we do is that we take that machine, we use our existing domain controller account. We have a series of safety checks as part of that. For those of you who attend my session, I'm going to talk about that. And we then talk to a PDC, and we use our current credentials as one of the domain controller accounts. Once we've done the authorization step, we use that to create a new domain controller account and switch identities on the underlying infrastructure when we actually go clone. So what it now enables, when you really think about it, what does cloning give me? Cloning gives me potential for these things. One is cloning gives me the ability to easily scale out if I need to by adding domain controllers based on your scale needs. It gives you a story to potentially have an easier deployment story for branch offices. It gives you potential to significantly reduce the time that it is for to doing a forest disaster recovery solution. So those are some of the three key things. Now, it's also possible for you to think about as using it for your test labs as well to create an equivalent environment before you isolate it. Cloning doesn't, we don't give you the capability. You still have to do all the standard safety checks that you do as part of isolating the environment when you set up a test lab. I'm going to skip this one. This is much more details of this. You can see a series from my, you can go back and look at the virtualization presentation. There's more details in terms of what our logic is there. Any questions on this? Good? This is much more details, but general questions around cloning or virtualization. All right. So one of the, a few more details is that we do require a PDC to be on Windows Server 2012. Sorry, did you have one?
Yeah, just one question.
So by the time we come up...
Can you repeat?
Sorry, that's a good point. The question was that how is replication handled when we're using the previous account and, you know, what is the internal mechanisms for doing that? Now, if you look at the step out here, is there a pointer? Okay, no, I don't see one. If you look at the step out here, that is a... When we come up, we detect that we have a... because I mentioned this VM generation ID. When we come up, we expect, based on the hypervisor platform, to have told us that, hey, something is different. So, and then when we come up, at that point in time, we've already reset our invocation ID. We've changed our identity so that replication can converge. And we've discarded our RID pool. And because there's a config file that is present that talks about the cloning, we start the cloning process. Once we do that, we locate a PDC. And when we call that PDC, we first do the authorization check. And if you look at the next step out there, we create a series of DC objects. We create the DC object for the new account, get the new credential for the domain controller as part of. This is typically what happens to the replication process as well, but that's bootstrapped through the domain admin credential. We use now, in this case, we bootstrapped it through the old computer account credential to actually do that. But once we've done that, it essentially means that we now have a new machine account and a new password as part of doing that, because the overall Active Directory environment, just like a new replica DC is given a new account to be able to do that, we've already done that as part of this environment, and we've passed that back through that call so that that establishes a new context for the machine as an underlying security principle, and from which we can do the rest of the replication infrastructure. It's just about we just get ourselves a new identity of sorts. VM clone or? So one aspect of cloning is that what we've done is that we've taken the whole operating system for a ride with us, along with whatever applications is available. In the cloning process, one of the key things that we've provided is a PowerShell commandlet to essentially make sure that we do not know if every service or every application is capable of cloning. So what we do is that we did was we tested in Windows, we tested quite a bit across all the Windows components to make sure all of those components are safely moved over into a new clone machine, because it is a running machine with running state. So we have to take care of that. Now, we do not know if other applications are capable of doing that. And so we have this notion of having an excluded application list. So what it means is that prior to us being able to generate a clone config file for you when you actually do that on a DC, we take that and we go inventory the machine for all the applications that are on the machine. If there are things that we do not recognize, we will block you from setting the clone config file. And it is required for the application admin to say, okay, I validated. Let me add this to an exclusion list. Let me validate that it's all good to be cloned in my environment before I make that application to be officially to be allowed to be cloned. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Actually, can I get in there for a moment? So the machine comes online, but it won't be a domain controller. It's preferring, it's doing all the checks first, and then it's figuring out, okay, I would have an issue if I become a domain controller, then it's changing its identity, and then it's starting to replicate. So there's no Active Directory replication before the machine recognizes that it's a clone.
Yes. Reboot has finished, plus a full replication sync has finished, because we make sure that everything is consistent.
The database is at a consistent state, the same way then if you create an AD snapshot, then the database is in a consistent state at this point of Q2, and that's just extending those possibilities we had before. Sorry, Sam.
Oh, no, yeah.
Carry on.
So let me also talk about a few more changes that we've done, a series of changes that we've had there. A quick kind of terminology set. Does everyone know what a root DSC mod is? Okay, root DC mod is a way for us to be able to do specific actions. Think of this as RPC to a domain controller. It's specified. There's specific standard types that you can actually do, and the system is hard-coded to understand them and perform an operation against that. Similarly, constructed attributes are things that don't, the actual value don't exist in the database. It's constructed out of other values together. This is also a system concept, and you need to know how those exist in the system has special code for that. LDAP controls are a way to actually customize behaviors about LDAP, because the reason why I bring it up is that we added a series of new LDAP controls that can help developers who use LDAP programming. And finally, we've also addressed a few of issues more core, where we made some improvements to RIDs, exposing DNTs for debugging, and a series of things. Now, this is an area I do want to kind of mention, because the reason why we put it in the deck is to make sure that people are also aware of this. So what we noticed was a series of customer calls leading to the notion of saying, hey, I don't have any more RIDs anymore, which implies that I cannot create any more security principles in my domain, which is really bad. At this point in time, a customer potentially is forced to migrate an environment to a new Active Directory forest. Now, what what were the problems that kind of related to that? We actually had to spend hours across support teams with customers to essentially work through to find out what the conditions resulted in these, because it was very difficult for us to find out, because it was over a period of potentially even a decade, and we didn't have enough data, so we had to go look at it. And after we looked through a few of the customer environments, we came to these as the key root causes as part of leading to a RID pool exhaustion. Now, the first thing was that if there was a failed user account creation because, let's say, the password policy did not match, what happens is that a domain controller actually discards that RID. And so you've lost one RID. So if a script ran quickly across, like, you know, just about 50, creating 50 users with the wrong password policy, you would lose 50 RIDs in that one go, for example. Now, similarly, computer account creation, because you didn't have the privilege, essentially will also result in a loss of one RID. but those were small. We couldn't necessarily account them for losing a potential 1 billion RIDs across the last decade in terms of creation of users. The big aspect was the third point. Now, if you had accidentally deleted your NTDS settings object for your domain controller, which has a lot of the metadata about your domain controller, what happens is that the system has special code to detect this condition and reincarnate that object. We reanimate that object, and we set a series of attributes. However, one thing that the system failed to do was that it forgot to add the RID set references attribute to this object. As a result of that, what happens is that that domain controller essentially would try to get a new RID pool, will try to apply that RID pool change from the RID pool change onto the RID set reference object, and it would fail to do so because it does not have that attribute. And it says, okay, it would discard that RID pool, and then 30 seconds later, go and ask the RID FISBO for another RID pool. All right? So this was really bad, because think about it as a block of 500 RIDs, and you're using, every 30 seconds, you're asking the RID FISBO owner for a block of 500 RIDs. So this was one of the big reasons. And in one customer environment we saw, because we didn't even have a max on the RID pool block size, they had made a typo, and instead of asking for 1,000 RIDs, they actually asked for 1,000,000 RIDs in the RID block size. So if you put those two things together, in that customer's environment, they pretty much exhausted their RID pools pretty quickly. Of course, I would say that we didn't do a great job of making sure that we published the messages as part of doing this as well. So even if a customer was looking at those event log messages, they would have had a hard time to figure this out. What did we do to fix this? We fixed the leaks, the small leaks, and we've also fixed the reincarnation. We pushed those down as QFEs as well into down-level platforms. Now, we also enforce a max cap on the RID pool block size so that, you know, hey, I don't think anyone needs more than 15,000 RIDs in one go. So it's very unnatural to actually go do that. A few more additional things that we did as part of doing this is that, of course, we've improved our logging, but we introduced an artificial ceiling as well. So every time that if you've approached 90% the global RID space, what it means is that we will say, sorry, we're going to stop creating security principles until an admin detects that, and essentially, but we do give you the control to switch it back on so that you can continue your security creation of security principles, but it's something to make sure that the admin is aware, right? So we added an artificial ceiling out there. Finally, we also said, okay, for customers potentially, we would ensure what the impact is, because if you do get in this situation, the impact is bad. You have to kind of go all the way. You potentially have to migrate to a new Active Directory forest or a domain. And what we did was unlock the 31st bit in our RID pool space. We've never used that so far. What it fundamentally gives you, how many more RIDs do you think that it gives you? It gives you an additional 1 billion RIDs as part of that. So we just doubled our RID pool space so that we we have the ability to kind of protect customers' environments as part of that. All of these are coming down both as QFEs as well as improvements to Windows Server 2012. So we first actually fixed them in 2012, and we're rolling out QFEs as well. A few more things is that a simple thing, if you create now updates to the schema, which requires you to update an index, because some of these attributes are indexed attributes, or what is a result is that as the schema update replicates over, you'll now see a lot of the DCs starting to kind of increase its CPU, because every of the DC in about 15 minutes is recreating its indexes or refreshing its indices. So what we did was to kind of help the admins essentially protect that environment and control that rollout a little bit. We have the ability to kind of defer that index creation. However, like on to the next reboot, as well as if you do update schema now against the machine, it will create the redo its indices at that point in time. A few more features. Now we're kind of going into some a little bit of the AD ecosystem features at this point in time. Now, from those, how many of you know that we already had the capability of an off-premises domain join, an offline domain join before? Yes. All right. Now, in Windows Server 2012, we fundamentally, this was driven out of some of our direct access and connectivity scenarios. The fundamental notion was that people are in organizations where organizations are changing the philosophy of saying that I have to buy the hardware and I have to provision before you access corporate resources. People are getting more into mobile scenarios where trying to kind of buy the hardware didn't seem to make sense anymore, because someone to get productive can go to the closest, let's say, some company that offers, let's say, a laptop, and they can buy it. And as long as they buy something that's recommended, then they can be quick to get access to corporate resources. So in conjunction with the direct access team, we worked on a way in which we can provision the whole notion of being able for you to connect you to your corporate environment through direct access, through ensuring that we got the right domain join blob available on the machine, plus the necessary group policy settings, plus necessary certificates, all of the things that is required for you to get access via direct access is something that we focused on, and that's provided in Windows Server 2012 and on Windows 8 client machines. Another thing is, how many of you saw any of the demos of connecting Windows 8 client machines to connected accounts, to Microsoft accounts? So you can now log in into your tablet with a Microsoft account. Did anyone see any?
Windows Live accounts.
Windows Live accounts. Mm-hmm. It's called Microsoft accounts, by the way. We've changed that. I'm still not used to the branding change. But so this is a feature where in a core Windows client code or client or server, which has local accounts, we now have the ability to bind those local accounts with Microsoft accounts. So you now can log in into your desktop, all right, with a Windows account. So your profile looks like I'm logging into my my Hotmail account, for example, would be what it would look like. However, those only work as part of logging in, is only supported with machines that are not domain joined. For domain joined machines, what we did was that the key benefit as part of doing that was essentially for you to be able to log in into using your Microsoft account, get single sign-on across all the some of the core Microsoft properties, let's say Messenger or Hotmail, or these were things that in the Windows 8 client that you actually could do that. However, for domain joined machines, we do not allow you to log in because that's part of a domain, and we not allow you to log in with a Microsoft account, but you still can gain benefits about some of the other value propositions there because you could have like one common set of like desktop settings across your personal machines and your work machines, or be able to connect up to some of your Microsoft services in a seamless fashion. Those are still supported as part of that. But because you are in a managed environment, we also gave the capability to ensure that through group policy, you can set a provide a setting such that you cannot necessarily connect these accounts to your domain account to a Microsoft account and perform some of these things. Any questions on that? The question was, I think it was Windows 7 that had the linked accounts. Did XP have that? I don't quite remember that. It could be. I'm not sure of XP, perhaps. The question was, is this the same as what was in XP? or is it something totally different? This is actually fairly different from even what was in Windows 7. Windows 7 had the notion of connecting up your Live ID at that point in time to your local account. That was done in a totally different way. In this case, we've actually enabled very core login support as part of logging into a Windows desktop to be able to log in using a Microsoft account. So that's something different now. It's not just a credential store. Yes? No, a machine cannot be domain joined to two different domains. We don't support that today. We've heard of that in the because of especially consultant scenarios where people need to kind of move from one environment to another on their laptop and wanting to kind of and organizations want to do. Is that the scenario that you're looking for fundamentally? Okay. We've heard of that, but we've not necessarily done anything specific to that yet. Yes?
I have two accounts, one Live ID. Can I choose one Live ID?
I believe on two machines you can do that.
Two machines, two different forwards?
Sorry, two. So the question was essentially, can I associate one Live ID or Microsoft account to two machines? Accounts on machines. I don't believe you can do it to two users on the same machine, but you can do it on two different machines.
We have actually a little bit clarification on the next slide.
Which one? Sorry.
The connected accounts Live ID logon to Windows with a connected Active Directory user account is not supported. Yeah. So.
Yes, you will be able to, but we'll probably maybe discuss that in a little more detail at the end if we have time. So let's just move on at this point. A few other small things was essentially from a debugging support, DNTs, think of them as your row numbers in a database. Active Directory is nothing but a distributed database. We have this NTDS file, .dit, which is our database, which is a JET database. Think of these as row numbers. Now, this is very useful for certain debugging thing purposes, and this was a request for some from our support team as well. This is an addition that we've kind of added to get back this information so that we can query the database to see what updates, and we'll be able to kind of jump from one DNT to another using database viewing tools. A few more things is that same thing from a support perspective. We've done a bunch of additional logging, so there's additional details that I've added at the end of this deck. better stats in terms of, you know, what comes in and what goes out. Unfortunately, we don't have very good fine granular logging, so if you do add this logging, it's mainly in debugging situations that you've added. It does generate a lot of logs, so this is something that it's just helpful for debugging purposes. This one's interesting because there's a series of LDAP controls that we've added. I'm not going to spend time on this at this moment, but we have details on each of these controls that's at the end of this deck in the appendix section. Now, I'll point out to one thing which might be interesting for people. Batched extended LDAP operations. What it gives you as potentially an admin or a developer building LDAP-based applications is that it gives you the ability to do multiple operations in a transactional mechanism. So typically, you couldn't do a specific transaction. It was based on AD's transactional capabilities. Now, you have the ability to kind of control saying that, do I want to do four different things at the same time? And if one of them fails, I want to fail the rest of the operation. So that's something that we actually offer as part of doing this, where we support that at the LDAP layer through transactional updates. Now, another thing to kind of point out was the tree delete control, because previously we could do a max of 16K at one point in time, but that kind of puts pressure on how long it takes for the data to converge. We give you a little more control to be able to do these types of deletions in a controlled manner where the admin can specify what the batch size is. So these are small things that we've kind of added through it based on specific feedback on certain areas. All right. So now we're going to talk a little bit more on the management side of things. And to kick that off, I'm going to hand it over to Ulf.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, so my name is Ulf Simon Wittner. I'm working for a computer center in Germany. And I started actually in 98 working on the very early bits of the future Windows 2000 and Active Directory. And I was very fascinated about Active Directory and all those technologies. So I've been in the space since the end of 98 and never got out there and don't feel like it. So my technical heart is still there. So we are very late in the presentation right now. We covered the first third and we have 20 minutes left. So I'm actually showing the next couple examples here just briefly in the UI, and afterwards we are skipping 10 slides. You have them for your reference after on. So let's see quickly. We don't need Twitter right now, but actually it's quite funny. We had a lot of buzz yesterday. We still have some things today. And let's go into Active Directory Administrative Center. I'm actually running the whole thing here of Server Core, because as you might have heard, Server Core is the new default installation. And my domain controller here is just a Server Core machine. You can see there's nothing on there but the command line. And let's go back to the desktop. So we have Active Directory Administrative Center here. First thing I want to show you that here in the graphical user interface, you're now able raise domain control, raise forest and domain functional level. You don't have to navigate through different things. And you're able to enable the recycle bin right out of the graphical user interface. This was something where you needed to remind some PowerShell command that in before. Right now you can do it in here when the forest and domain functional level are at Windows Server 2008 R2 or higher. One thing, you can decrease forest and domain functional levels down to Windows Server 2008 if you didn't turn on the recycle bin. However, this is not possible in the graphical user interface. You have to go into PowerShell doing this, but that's not the most likely scenario, so that's fine. So I already enabled the recycle bin here to show you that we are actually able to undelete objects now. So after I enabled the recycle bin, I get the deleted objects container here in the Active Directory Administrative Center. And I see that I have two objects here which got deleted. And what's very helpful here, I'm only able to restore single objects. And we will get a little bit more into this afternoon. I have a session about the evolution of Active Directory recovery. I hope you're coming there. And we will go into DNTs, how the Active Directory database is changing when you enable the recycle bin, and also how to possibly do tree undeletes. But right now in the graphical user interface, I'm only able to undelete one object. So I have actually to verify that the parent is live. But I can see if I go here on show and I go on locate parent, I can see that the parent is also deleted because that is the Amsterdam OU. So I actually can undelete the Amsterdam OU first, and then I can undelete Joe. I would also be able to undelete Joe right away, but this would require me to specify a new parent because I can't undelete Joe to an object which didn't exist. But if I, for example, say, okay, the whole OU got deleted on purpose, but this one's user needs to be saved, then I can restore the user to a different location. So I undeleted him to his default location, and if I go here into my users, am I blind? Okay, I'm kind of blind right now in the interface here. My servers, my groups, my. No, I can't find the. Oh, here, my users. Okay, so it's not sorting for some reason. And I can see that the Amsterdam OU is undeleted and the show user is back there, and he maintains all group memberships, everything, but we will get into this afternoon. What's also very helpful. Sometimes you are doing things in the Active Directory Administrative Center and you're wondering, okay, I need to do this on multiple OUs, stuff like this. Wouldn't it be easier to use some PowerShell or some other script? So we actually have the PowerShell history viewer. And if you click down here, you can actually see all the commands, what we did just to undelete the user. And you can copy them out. You can create your own scripts and so on. The last thing I want to show you in the graphical user interface, what has changed, is that we are able now to modify the password settings objects. And password settings was a kind, the only graphical user interface we had there was called ADSI Edit. And there are probably a couple of people in this room who feel comfortable modifying Active Directory using etc edit. However, I guess that the most administrators prefer to use more richer interfaces. So creating password settings is now enabled in the GUI. It's converting all those names for you. If you put a time in there, it's automatically converting to the number format, which is expected in Active Directory and those things. So it's way easier to do those. And you can actually see down here where those password settings apply to, which was a hassle to figure out before because you had to go into etc edit to see specific attributes there. So you have a full GUI now for this task too. Let's switch back to PowerPoint. And since I just promised, we can skip now a lot of slides, which are there for your reference later. We covered the recycle bin, and we will cover more recycle bin this afternoon. History viewer is there. And we have fine-grained password policies. Now, the next thing here I have on the slides is group managed service accounts. Who in here heard about managed service accounts? Okay, couple. So the limitation of managed service accounts was that a managed service account is limited to a domain member. So if you create a managed service account before Windows Server 2012, the managed service account was only able to maintain from one machine. So it was an Active Directory-based account, but the passwords, which are changed on a regular basis, this was controlled from a computer account. So the service where this account was running was managing the password, and you weren't able to have the same user account across multiple machines in your domain. And with group managed service accounts, make it short, it has changed. So you have one, if you have one Windows Server 2012 domain controller, he will create something what we call the GKDS, and he's taking care of changing the passwords, and the clients or the domain members who are running with the service accounts which have any services there are synchronizing the passwords password down there, and they are taking sure that the services consoles are taking care that they are using the new account with the new password automatically. So you don't have to do a lot of things there. And it's easy to implement because it's only running on Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012 domain members right now, which is totally okay. And you need at least one Active Directory domain controller, which also requires the schema that you're able to provision those accounts and that somebody is taking care of this. And the last thing what I'm covering right now is Active Directory replication topology and commandlets. In the past, we've had a lot of commands, repadmin, repelmon, if you had earlier versions of the operating system, ntdsutil, Active Directory sites and services, and so on. So we had a lot of commands. And when I was actually scripting those things, I was always using a mixture between VBScript and command line tools because some things are more powerful when you had the command line tools. Other things were more controllable using VBScript. So I always had a combination of different languages. In Windows Server 2012, the Active Directory product team did a great investment in creating as many Active Directory commandlets as are useful for you. So we are able to control sites, subnets, site links, replication, all those things we are able to control via PowerShell. We can also look at the repadmin stuff like replication metadata and those things. We can use Active Directory PowerShell to look into there. Okay, enough said. I'm making it short. We have 15 minutes to go and back to Sam. Thank you.
All right. So actually, we do have a little bit of time because it's all based on how many questions we do, so we can do questions after the session as well if people are interested. Couple of things, because most of the rest of the things, while the Kerberos enhancements, I'll probably spend a little bit more time. Dynamic access control is something that you've already seen. So let me start off with... So let me start with AD-based activation. You probably already know there's, for in terms of managing activation, you potentially have to set up a separate KMS server, and this is painful. There's a series of things in terms of having dependency on RPC, and this is difficult to maintain. So what we've done in Windows Server 2012 is essentially move it to be much more Active Directory integrated, so your domain join machines, you do not need a separate KMS service. Excuse me. However, the KMS service for down-level volume licensing requirements, you still need that. And over a period of time, you can phase out and not necessarily need to maintain an additional KMS server to manage your activations at this point in time. The next one essentially is something that I am going to focus a little bit on. How many of you know what Kerberos constraint delegation is? Now, one of the challenges, so Kerberos constraint delegation is the ability of one principal or security principal to impersonate another user when accessing a resource. So you see this traditionally in multi-tiered applications where they need support for that. So let's assume that you're accessing a front-end web application. From there, you need to go talk to a back-end SQL application. So what you need to do is that you want to authorize based on the user that came into the front-end, all right? So let's say me, I'm Sam, and I access the application. The application is running under a service account. Now, it needs to go talk to a database, but it wants to talk to the database as me, all right? Because all the ACLing is done based on me so that it wants to make sure that the right model is being done so that it doesn't have to maintain all the authorization logic in the front end. So that's the fundamental reason why you typically have delegation scenarios. Now, the problem, we do always have this Kerberos constraint delegation model where the service account can impersonate me and then talk to the backend application. However, there was a series of problems. 1A, it required that the service account, the user account, and the resource all be part of the same domain. And typically where customers needed to use that was in the extranet. So what it said is that, I've got to be in the same domain across inside and outside for those types of accounts and for me to be able to do that. That was not very practical for a lot of customers, and it made it very difficult to use. It was difficult to configure as well. Similarly, it kind of gave godlike privileges across a series of operations, so people were very apprehensive about using this. So what we've done... So what we've done in Windows Server 2012 is essentially we've taken this and we've made it a lot better. So now you don't necessarily have to think about it as being specific to a certain domain of forest. You can truly kind of, for extended scenarios, you can use your one-way trust model that customers typically have, where the extended forest trusts the intranet forest. And we've also made it such that it is fundamentally based on the resource, the back-end resource that whose resource is being accessed as. So at that place, you can define what are the security principles that can access the resource, resource service account. So for example, if the database is running as service account, as one service account, you can just go to that database account and say, hey, I allow impersonation tokens from security principle A or security principle B. So this gives you the ability to kind of control your environment in a much more flexible manner, and we believe that this kind of opens up a lot of potential for application scenarios in your Active Directory environment. Another key change that happened in Windows Server 2012 is the notion of us supporting what's known as flexible authentication secure tunneling. Now, this is a place where this, think of it as additional security improvements to Kerberos. Now, there are certain places where Kerberos, it is potential where certain error conditions can be spoofable in Kerberos. So we've kind of gone a step further in Kerberos to kind of improve that, because in some very high security environments, customers require even more tighter controls, and this is to support that. What we've done is that this essentially, we've added additional protection mechanisms when a KDC client, is the one that's like, think of it as a Kerberos client on any Windows machine, talks to the KDC server, which is essentially an Active Directory domain controller for us. And we've improved the security of that communication by protecting some of that communication channel using the computer's own security principle. Because there is already computer authentication that happens, we can overlay some of that security context into the communication between when a user tries to authenticate to a Kerberos server when trying to get a service ticket to any application. So this is something that we've added as an additional protection. We also provide you the controls. Again, this is also a place that we enable this, and for specific things, we added controls such that we do not necessarily require any form of functional levels, but we gave you the policy controls in group policy so that you can control saying that, hey, for example, I've got enough Windows 8 machines as well as I've got enough Windows 8 DCs. I can kind of, for those machines, I can kind of turn on fast. Or once you're ready to do it across every, because you do not have any of the old machines, you can do it across your full environment and require this as well. Okay. Finally, dynamic access control. Traditionally, our whole authorization story in Windows has been based on just group information. But how many of you have always kind of thought, hey, I've already got my necessary information in the directory, and all I'm doing is writing a script to convert that directory information into a group so that I can authorize using an ACL? How many of you have done that? All right. So this is our focus on being able to improve this. We've already got a great set of directory data. we worked on saying that, how can we improve the platform to provide richer authentication, richer authorization capabilities? This fundamentally, think of this as a few key primitives in terms of our improvements. The first one is that we've improved the core of our authorization. Think of it as our authz check APIs in any Windows 8 machine. It now understands claims in addition to SIDs. So that was a key addition that we've had, so that now not only do you get user group information in your Windows token, you can also get claims like department equals finance or cost center equals blah. There's a bunch of these claims that you can actually get into your Windows token or even an organization or whatever set of this. So that becomes a core primitive that we've added in Windows. Now, not only did that, we added an additional capability of something called device authentication to drive scenarios as well, and I already mentioned about that when I talked about ADFS earlier. So we've added the ability to merge both user principles and device principles, which is Windows 8 domain joined machines only, to be able to blend them so that now if you want to go to the Acling editor, you can actually say user.department equals or is one of a list of departments and device dot, let's say device dot department equals finance. So I can actually create a policy-based ACL expression that can be applied to resources. So this was the core. But the way we drove it was essentially about providing a workload where we lit up the first workload, which is the file server, because the file server has difficulties because there are potentially thousands of file servers in an organization or hundreds, and trying to kind of enforce information security controls in a compliant way was difficult. So we used these claims-based expressions, and for the file server, we enhanced that expression to also use a resource context. So now I can say for resource.sensitivity equals HBI, high business impact, ensure that read access is only allowed for user.department equals finance and device.department equals finance. So that's the level of flexibility that we've really pushed in the authorization logic in the core of Windows, and that's by a combination of both the Windows client team as well as the Windows server team, the Active Directory team, that we provide that functionality. Now, as part of doing the overall file server scheme, we've also enhanced the series set of capabilities that we provide there by providing centralized policies. So now you can create these centralized policies and send them via group policy to various machines, like to your file servers, that they can consume and say, for all sensitive documents, you have to go through a policy where user.employee type equals full-time employee, because you do not want to provide any vendor access with that. So that's the series of improvements that we need. As part of also the platform changes, we also improved auditing. Because auditing, the challenge with auditing was that it was really voluminous, all right? For anyone who's ever used auditing, you always go, how the hell do I read this information, you know? It's very hard to do this. There's just way too many audits. I have no idea what to do. Because I know what I want to audit, but just to get those two audits, I have to generate about 2,000 audits and be able to go look through them and do that. So what we've done is, I just gave you this expression-based way. Think of auditing is always triggered using SACL mechanisms. It's also based on our security descriptor. We've enhanced that saying that now you can, just the way you did authorization logic, all right, you can say for resource.sensitivity equals HBI, audit all successes only for user.employee type equals vendor or not equals full-time. Now, what it means is that for any of your sensitive applications, you're going to audit any access from your vendors. And that's the only thing that you really, because that's what you care about, because that's what your audit, you know, who was asking for your audits essentially cares about. You can essentially focus these expressions to drive audits to be limited to exactly what you need to actually go do. So that's the core set of auditing capabilities as part of the platform. So you can see there's a series of the ACL editors is improved quite a bit as part of being able to express these policies. And for centralized policies, we've actually focused all those improvements in ADAC. So in ADAC, Active Directory Administrative Center, you'll see a new section called Dynamic Access Control where you can create these centralized policies. You can create claims on, you can decide which claim you want to be added to the Windows token so that a file server can consume it or even an application can consume it. You can drive that all through Active Directory Administrative Center now. All right. I've already talked about some of these. So I'm kind of going to summarize a little bit. There's a series of improvements that we targeted in terms of thinking about making it easier to deploy and manage. And so if you really think about it, like our focus, we made virtualization to be much better, safer, better in terms of cloning. We've done a series of improvements around deployment to ensure that we figured out what were the common issues that people had, and we've tried to optimize those experiences and make them less error-prone through improvements where you don't have to do AD prep anymore. It's well integrated with Server Manager. You have things remotable. Things are in PowerShell. So we've given you the full set of capabilities to be successful through your Active Directory deployments. We've made enhancements through a UI because typically, you know, we always want to do a lot of things, but at the same point in time, we have to kind of go execute only across a finite period of time with a finite set of resources. So we made a series of investments on the management side where we made improvements to our UI. We've added more PowerShell capabilities and given that to you so that you can kind of manage your Active Directory environments. Across the board, we've also made, like, for example, I think that Kerberos improvements to Kerberos constrained delegation is a key benefit across AD environments because it just lights up new scenarios that you just couldn't do that before. And we focused also on series of things in terms of ensuring that we took dynamic access control and we added new sets of claims-based capabilities into the platform so that it gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of running authorization, doing auditing, and enables you as an Active Directory administrator to help potentially managing file servers by driving policies as part of that. Now, throughout this, I've already mentioned that we've essentially focused on trying to ensure to the best of our capabilities that you as a customer are not necessarily forced to go to any functional levels to get benefit. So we've tried to say how much of value proposition that can we push without necessarily forcing anyone to actually move to a new functional level. And as part of this, when you really think about it, on any Server 2012 member server, you get a series of capabilities where you do get through remote RSAT, you get the new ADAC, so you get all the new UI capabilities that, for example, Ulf pointed out around password, find main password policy or recycle bin user interface. You get all those set of authorization capabilities that I talked about because you get these full policy expressions as part of any Windows 8 member machine. So for people, you know, if you're talking to the developers in your organization, they'll probably say that, hey, you can kind of go make use of some of these when in development patterns. Now, we talked about Active Directory-based activation because you get that as a core aspect in Windows Server 2012. Similarly, you get a series of replication and topology commandlets because those are also part of the RSAT pack. You can now deploy ADFS 2.1 as on a member server in Windows Server 2012, or you can deploy it on your domain controllers as well. In terms of our first DC, of course, you know, you've already done scheme updates. You get all the deployment benefits that we've had. You get GMSA as part of that. You get the Kerberos constraint delegation. You also light up some of the dynamic access control scenarios because we can do claims without necessarily forcing you to be at a domain level. We just need enough number of DCs for how many of our clients that you need to support claims. We've also kind of made those improvements where on Windows Server 2012 DCs now, on a Windows Server 2012 hypervisor platform, you can use all the safeguards that we provided for virtualization of DCs, as well as, you know, it becomes a stepping stone for you to do more cloning. That's for the cloning aspect of it. We do require the PDC to be Windows Server 2012 because we have to run some of those authorization checks and how we change context, those were specific things that we had to require one machine to be available for us to seed from, as well as for us to be able to authenticate with when we're going through the cloning process. So there's one place where you potentially have to get into a functional level, which is in a dynamic access control in a multi-forest environment. We require you, because the way Kerberos does cross-realm tickets, like because when I'm a user accessing a resource in another forest, I actually get from my own user forest, I get a cross-realm ticket to the resource forest, and then the resource forest gives me a service ticket. For that, we need the root domains to actually be at domain functional level of Windows Server 2012. Sorry. So I am pretty much done. We can ask a bunch of questions. So feel free, please do send feedback on sessions.
Actually,
Yes.
Actually, we have some issue there because this repeat session was brought up pretty late. So the guys who are doing the evaluations don't have the evaluation right for this session. So, but it will be available sometimes during this morning. They are currently working on it, and we just send a couple high priority mails down there. So please evaluate the session, but you can't do it right now. Sorry. But I hope you enjoyed the session. I'm available. I think you have to leave, right?
I'm available for the next 15 minutes.
Okay, so we are here. I will be down in the attendee hall or in the technical learning area later. And I also have the session at 2:45 this afternoon. So come by, enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.
All right, thank you.